Greetings, everybody, and welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. It's me, Chris Denson, your gracious host, coming at you once again live. Well, it's not really live, is it? We're taping this. So if you guys are tuning in for the first time ever, this show covers all things innovation, ideas, creativity, smart people doing smart things. And today, I think it's one of the smartest of them all, at least in a long time. Say hello, Greg Larkin.
Hello.
Very much on the nose there. For those who may not know, you're a new author, but before we get into the book, are you a new author, by the way?
Or this is my first book.
All right. We'll talk about that too. Give us a little bit of a 101 on what a Greg Larkin is.
Greg Larkin is a entrepreneur. Launched my first startup in 2005, and we got acquired in 2009. And during that process,
it's an interesting time period.
Well, the reason we got acquired is that my first product launch was the first prediction that the then booming housing market was going to collapse. That was my introduction to being a product strategist.
Yeah.
And we pissed a bunch of people off when it first came out in 2006. But as what we predicted started to materialize, we made a lot of money and we got bought by a larger company, and I had to make the transition from startup entrepreneur to corporate entrepreneur. And that was probably the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my entire life.
Really?
Yeah.
That's definitely a bold statement. Why say it's the hardest thing ever?
A lot of the superpowers that make a good entrepreneur good at what they do are they you cease to have those powers in a big company. You slam into this wall of intransigence, this wall of can't.
Yes.
And it's, you know, I think as an entrepreneur in a startup, you look around you and you're surrounded by people you love doing work you love. You're in awe of the mountain you're trying to move, and you're inspired by the people you're moving it with. And then you go to a big company and you're surrounded by a lot of people whose only ambition is to go from being a vice president to a senior vice president.
Yes. They need an S. Yeah. I got to get that S on my card.
And so I think just the way in which people were wired, the way in which people were motivated by status rather than impact, I guess.
Yeah.
Kind of took me by surprise. And this book is a lot about how I learned how to be an entrepreneur, how to move really fast, do some amazing product launches. But more than anything, it's a prayer, I suppose, because I don't want, there are so many entrepreneurs in big companies that don't have a resource.
Yeah.
It can be a very lonely existence. It could feel like you're the only one in there. And so I really want this book to form a community and mobilize other entrepreneurs to find one another and to do the best work of their lives inside of those companies.
That's brilliant. So going back to the entrepreneurial side of you for a second, was that product that you created? And then how did you, you know, what was that journey like over the course of four years, I guess?
Yeah. So Innovest was an investment research startup based out of Toronto and New York and later on in London. When they brought me on, to initiate coverage of the banking industry. Bear in mind, this was 2005.
Yeah.
So being a fintech startup at that time was sort of, you wanted to be quiet about that. It wasn't cool. It especially wasn't cool in New York, where Wall Street was going bananas.
Yep.
So we constantly were this startup that pretended we were a Wall Street, you know, boutique research shop.
Yeah.
And then as soon as Wall Street started to unravel, we're like, no, we're going to be an out of the closet startup and be proud of it and wear those battle scars with honor.
Yeah.
And so the product that I was looking at, the very condensed version, is essentially it looked at where were there pockets of borrowers in the U.S. where the amount of debt that they were taking on was growing at like a 2x the rate at which their wages were growing. Does that make sense?
Yep.
And then from that, we were able to tie it into like which were the banks that were lending them the money.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we
yeah.
were very Jeez. Early to predict like Lehman Brothers, not going to be here for a long time. Bear Stearns, not going to be here for a long time. Merrill Lynch on life support. We predicted it all and we were the first to do it.
What did it do for you like career wise? Was that like a big boost, or was it like, oh, that wasn't quite the impact I thought it was going to have, or was it somewhere in the middle?
Good question. So initially it was scary as hell. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. Before the prediction actually materialized, a lot of the banks also happened to be our clients, and they were calling me personally. And they were saying, you know, have you ever been on the receiving end of a libel lawsuit? Oh, have wow. you ever been? So it really scared the shit out of me. And I'd say one of the.
Did you have a fake mustache? Just yeah, right. walk around. Greg? No, I don't know anybody named Greg.
I had a fake mustache, but it had nothing to do with that.
Shouldn't we all? I think that'll be the title all? Of this episode. Fake mustaches.
Fake mustache, yeah, man. Yeah. But I'll tell you, one of the. To this day, my CEO from that time, Matthew Kiernan, he lives in London now. He could call on me and be like, hey, I'm in a bit of trouble. Can you be on the next plane out here? Because I'll never forget this. One of those banks called the both of us up, and I could say who they were. It was Lehman Brothers. They're not here anymore. So
that's true.
And said, look, First of all, we're a client. We're going to cancel our contract. Second of all, we're going to sue you. And Lehman gave us 20 minutes to pull this report down. And I called up my CEO, Matthew. And I'm like, I was ready to offer my resignation. And so I said, listen, I cannot believe I put you in this position. I'm so sorry. I am offering my resignation. I'm happy to get out of your hair. I just feel like such an ass. And he said, hold on. Let me just be clear. Are they uncomfortable with your facts or with your opinions? Because if your facts are solid, that's a very different thing.
Right, right.
Than if your opinion, you know. I said, look, the data is correct. They may not be comfortable with the conclusions. And he said, all right, good. He said, listen to me. Let's get them back on the phone. Before we get on the phone, people don't fight you this hard when you're wrong. I will never, as an entrepreneur, I am going to have that tattooed on my arm. People don't fight you that hard when you're wrong.
Well, I was going to ask you too, like what did that teach you? And I think is also kind of reflective in the book, or at least the thesis of the book, about brutal honesty, right? Because I think there's an honesty that comes with whether you're helping somebody invent and there's a truth that they don't see about their company. Or in this case, where you're like, hey, this is... It's valuable information, but even though you're resisting it.
I think honestly that the biggest thing it taught me is that as an entrepreneur, you have to understand that opposition is validation. It's one thing to gain, you know, 3x your like monthly active users and to like 3x your revenue and 10x this and 10x that. That's great. And that's extremely hard in its own right. But if you're really doing it right, someone who thinks they're supposed to be doing it already is going to feel threatened by you and they're going to come after you. And that is a fact of life. Every entrepreneur who's ever done anything that mattered has a story about that.
I was going to say, it sounds like Clayton.
Yeah.
which the quote I wrote down was, let's go back inside and kick some ass. And then 2 months later, he retired.
Right.
Right. Or he left. Sorry.
Yes.
So because I think it's a great example of what you were just talking about. But I would love for you to expound on that like anecdote.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever used the word expound before. So nor do I know if I use it correctly.
But you get
my drift, right?
I do.
Okay.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
It's a good word.
I wish we had like word. Confetti and like horns and
stuff.
Yeah.
I don't think you've ever used the word mazel tov before, but mazel tov.
Thank you. It's two firsts in 2 minutes.
Yeah, so that was one of the most eye-opening experiences later on in my life once I kind of figured out a bit about how to launch great products and as an entrepreneur inside of a big company. And it was a product launch with PwC. For those in your audience that don't know who PwC, it is a 179-year-old accounting firm that eventually became a strategy consultancy.
Oh, so not the rapper.
No, different guy.
Okay. Right.
He worked there first.
Oh, right. Yeah. It's like, pump this. I'm going to rap.
And yeah, so one of the products that I launched with them was doing great. It was a cash flow management tool. Basically, it gave a lot of the advice that PwC gets paid millions to give to Fortune 100 CFOs and made it accessible in an app for everybody.
Wow.
And we're at this launch party here in LA for that app. And in the room are like 100 tech executives from like Oracle, Microsoft, Google, across the spectrum. And they were so excited about this. This was sort of the product they were waiting for. And from the company they were waiting for to build it. And this guy who I'm calling Clayton, that's not his real name.
I figured. That's why I just blared it out.
Yeah, so a guy who I'm also going to call Tom. He was the guy who managed the whole project with PwC, brought me on as an advisor. And it was a great product, still on my like top five I've ever built. And but Clayton is seeing this punk, this guy who's like late 30s, me and Tom work in the room, we gave the demo and people were like afterwards were just all over us, like, when can we set up meetings, we need to get our like CFO on board, like, when you're coming out to Seattle, you know. It was everything you want a product launch to be. And Clayton was thought that those were his clients. And suddenly this upstart is standing in between him and his clients. And he says to Tom, hey, there's someone I want to introduce you to. And he kind of steers him out of the room. And once they're like 5 minutes away, he narrows his brow. And I could see this. And then afterwards, I'm like, what was going on there, Tom? And he tells me exactly what words were said.
Right.
He says, are you fucking crazy? Oracle is my client. Microsoft is my client. I don't hear about this event. You come in and you're speaking to my clients. This is bullshit. And like, I've been in that situation. I've never actually launched an enterprise product where that didn't happen. The way in which Tom reacted was totally an inflection point for my life, because he said, look, if you want to tell everyone that's excited about this product, and if you want to tell everyone in PwC that needs this product to win, here's what I suggest you do. Go back inside, tap a fucking spoon on your glass, and announce to all of them that I've been fired. In fact, I'm begging you to do that, because I am sick of this shit. I'm going to go on with my life. You go on with yours. If you want me to be building as an entrepreneur on the outside, the four walls of this organization, going after those same clients, let's make that happen right now. And Clayton went from like venomous to placating, and he kind of motioned with his arms like, Tom, please calm down. Just get a hold of yourself.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I should have been more involved. I realize I haven't been as supportive as I need to. That's on me. I didn't realize that this was being built. And let's go back inside and kiss some ass. And Clayton retired 2 months after that.
Wow.
And we went on, me and Tom went on to launch six more products inside of that company.
I guess in some part therein lies the entrepreneur's journey, right? And there's a balance between, and I'm curious what your thought is on this. There's a balance between how much you build versus how much you pitch and bring people into the fold in the process. Mm. You know, like my brother, for instance, works for the city of Detroit, and he worked on the whole LinkedIn moving their offices there, and he got that call from the mayor. He's like, why didn't I know about this? And he said to the mayor, like, every time I tell somebody, too many cooks get in the kitchen and it never happens.
Yeah.
So, but there's a balance between those two, pissing somebody off and asking for an apology later or whatever. Like, you know, what is the balance that you've kind of seen, or is there one?
Yeah. There is a balance, and it took me a long time to figure it out. But I think the biggest trap that every entrepreneur falls into, and the way in which companies tell people to be innovators, is pitch your ideas, show me your ideas. And in reality, no one gives a shit about an idea. It's easy for an executive with power to say no to an idea. And so I think my biggest advice, and as it goes to that balance, is don't pitch an idea, only pitch an outcome. And that's exactly in that anecdote about Tom. That's what he did. If he had asked Clayton, hey, would you mind if I built this new cash flow management app? The answer would have been no, absolutely not, because Clayton didn't want Tom to be in that room with that result.
Right.
But once the train had left the station, once he was generating incredible market validation and those executives were excited about it, now it's a risk for Clayton to stand in the way and say no.
Right.
And I, you know, the reason the book is called This Might Get Me Fired is because once you use your product and launch it very quickly, as fast as you would inside of a startup, and you get results that are mission critical for the organization to grow and to thrive and survive, if you don't use that as leverage to transform the culture of your organization, if you don't use that as leverage to make your supporters take a stand on your behalf, or to convert skeptics into supporters, or to neutralize your opponents, you're going to fail. Yeah. That's the difference between an entrepreneur and an intrapreneur. An entrepreneur doesn't have to deal with that. They don't have to change an organization. All the things they have to change are on the outside of their company. An intrapreneur, your biggest enemy is your own company.
Yeah.
And you have to use the thing you're building and build it to a point where you're more of a threat if you're outside than inside. Then you can start changing hearts and minds.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I've attended too many funerals, I guess, is the way I think of it. And when I say that, I mean,
you've murdered a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I go to the funerals. After. Oh, poor fella.
The least I can do is buy some roses.
That might get you fired, actually.
Yeah, but you're not going to tell anyone.
All right, so this metaphor of yours.
Yeah, well, I think that was one of the hardest things for me to experience when I was like, I was the head of innovation at Bloomberg for about 4 years. And it was really hard for me to see incredible entrepreneurs build incredible products and just see them die, and see the entrepreneurs who outside of that organization would have been rock stars, rock star founders. Many of them were rock star founders. Mm-hmm. In fact, I myself had a huge achievement as an entrepreneur. And over time, you kind of become deferential and suffocated and stuck, right, and institutionalized. And that's the saddest thing you can see.
Yeah.
That's so much wasted talent, and the extent to which those same folks kind of, something inside of them dies after a while. And, you know, 10 years ago, I could kind of understand why that would matter.
Yeah.
Because your job as a responsible grown-up was to get a job at a company like that and stay there for life. Now, your job as a responsible adult is to participate in the disruption economy. The barriers to entry for an entrepreneur to kick the shit out of a company that cannot get out of its own way have never been lower.
Yeah.
And if you have that ability, if you have that superpower, and you're not constantly exercising and honing that muscle, you're doing yourself a disservice. You're taking more personal risk with your career, with your financial stability.
Your emotional stability.
Your emotional stability.
Yep.
And there's this miscalculation of risk and reward where it's like, well, you know, I'm not going to become that senior vice president. In fact, I might get a shitty annual performance review.
Right.
So I'm going to become less of the entrepreneur that I am.
But There are, like, you know, let me back up. I think there are certain organizations who are, and there's few of them, that are primed to harness the power of an entrepreneur. Or a set of them. Like, I run the innovations team for OMD, right? And it's the largest media agency in the world. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time to make that decision to go in-house, but I had to look at how they support this ecosystem, because I've run into a lot of friends, as you mentioned, who have died internally somewhere because, you know, they're the one innovation person and nobody ever talks to them. They bring something awesome in and it's like, that was cool. So anyway, right, it's just this progression where they're not heard and they're not exercising, like you said, their ability. So, you know, where have you seen some traits where companies have done a great job of supporting this, you know, this individual or this group of individuals and not?
So first of all, I actually don't think we've seen it happen full force yet. I think we're at the beginning of that.
Yeah.
And the extent to which you have companies that have made the transition from, we think innovation is interesting, you see a lot of companies that are now saying, we think it's important, and you see a few other companies saying, we think it's urgent. Very few, though.
Yeah.
And the extent to which you have people doing innovative moves, but solving problems that don't really affect a company's growth or profitability, means that you get a lot of wasted talent that's sort of like, all right, well, we'll get back to you after we speak to our investors this quarter. And so I don't think we've seen any company get this fully right yet. I think we've seen pockets and companies do it. But there's very few companies, I think, which have done a good job of understanding the costs of not innovating and have activated the entrepreneurs inside of their organization to solve that problem.
Right.
And there's a flip side to that. You know, Google's in the business for Google and for some of and Facebook and LinkedIn, like you mentioned before. If they don't, they're in the business of innovation. Yes, and I think they have an inherent understanding that for them to survive, they have to be as hungry as the entrepreneurs that want to steal market share from them. That's in the DNA of the founders. That's where they were born. You know, I think scaling that is hard for the simple reason that it's hard to scale entrepreneurship. But I clearly they're trying, but that's their job, right? Their investors expect that from them. Their organization, that's the premise of their organization. I think where I live is a different domain, right? Like, I just worked with Nestle and I worked with Goldman Sachs and I worked with Bloomberg. Those are really old industries.
Yeah.
PwC, you know, those industries have been around for a very long time, and the people who are running things inside of those companies have been there for 30, 40 years sometimes. And they think they've got it right. And they're not typically open to the fact that they don't. And to the extent that sometimes you find a guy, and I thank God have met these people who are like, they wake up with the zeal of the newly converted as it pertains to innovation.
Yes.
And they're going to spread the gospel, and God bless them all.
I was going to ask you, because I mean, I think in the case of Clayton, right, it's you and Tom, finding those internal stakeholders who will be champions for whatever your vision is.
Yeah.
Is that harder than it seems or easier than it seems?
It's very hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard. It's really hard, and it often happens as an act of desperation rather than, hey, I've got this really exciting thing. It's like you have a rumor about a startup that was acquired, and the CEO of that startup has become very senior inside of the organization that bought him. And you're like, listen, please, can you give me a reason to stay here? Because I can't go on like this. Mm-hmm. That's often when you find your champion, you find your godfather. And that godfather is mission critical because you don't get stakeholder validation without them. But that's typically not, you know, on paper, it's like, hey, we're going to be best buddies and I'm innovative and you're an innovator and let's do it.
Yeah.
No, it should be hard. Like it's hard. It's hard for them to say yes, because they realize what you're trying to do might require them to spend their political capital in the organization in a way that might be of risk, put them at risk. I don't know. You know, I'll say his first name because I didn't get his explicit permission. But the guy who my godfather at PwC was a guy called Dave, and he had been a CEO of. I'll say this. He was the CEO of PwC Japan.
I'm loving all this top secret information. I'm getting.
Right? So he was the CEO of PwC Japan. Everyone in the organization with power owed him something, right? He was instrumental in kind of transforming that company from an accounting firm to a strategy consulting firm.
Wow.
And no one could not return his call. And he used that power for us, you know, and not only that, he was fascinated by what we were doing. So we're like a bunch of pirates in a design studio with like Sharpies and everyone's writing code. And
I think I think it's important. It's kind of like, yes, in a position of power, but also a fan. Right. I think there has to be somebody who's like a fan of you as an individual and whatever is in your head that's out on paper or being built and the whole through line. I think
that's the thing. We had fun together.
Yeah.
And he loved the fact that he finally had something that he could talk to his grandchildren about that they would think was cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were off the main office of PwC. We were working out of this like really beat up design studio that stank of Sharpie ink, and there'd always be some like punk music playing. It was awesome. It was
a completely random kind of vibe.
It was great.
PwC, Sharpie ink, and punk music. That's yes.
Yeah, I don't know if you know that, but Joey Ramone was a co-founder of PwC.
No. Really? No, shut up. Okay. Right. My gullibleness just all poured out of me. It's too early.
But
he did. Let me Google this. I'm gonna tweet it out. The Ramones.
You heard it here first.
179 years ago.
Yeah. Except then they were called Oscar Wilde, but whatever.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, he was instrumental because every time he every week when we were like planning, all right, what are we doing? Why is it a priority? How are we going to do it? Part of what we were talking about during that time was what are we building and how are we going to test it with the market?
Right.
For him, and it was instrumental and mission critical for us to hear him, it was who are you going to convert?
Yeah.
What's the guy who you're bringing into our studio to like fall in love with what we're building and to back us? And what are we asking them to do? Are we asking them to give us money? Are we asking them to have them introduce us to somebody else? Like what specifically are we asking those other executives inside of this organization to do to demonstrate their support for us? And, you know, what wound up happening was that our growth with our customers was totally backed up by growth within the executive power structure of a huge organization that is otherwise really kind of impenetrable.
Yeah.
And it was sort of these two snowballs reinforcing one another and getting bigger and stronger and momentum building. That's powerful because that's the real change happening.
100%. Do you think that there's... Is there a part of the process that you love the most? Because I think there's a lot. There's the idea building. There's the product making. There's the political conversion.
Yeah.
There's so many different components to go into make. And I think you have to love like the game entirely in order to survive it. But is there one thing that you like that's, I don't know, kind of falls into your superpower or you're like, yes, this is where I, you know, this is the part of the process I like the most.
Yeah, 100%. I like the political conversions, but only because they are in service of what I would call this like magic moment. And that's when, man, I have like a zillion, as soon as I say it, I get like goosebumps because it's amazing. Look, anytime you build something new, you never know if anyone gives a shit. You have a hypothesis about what people need and want and don't already have,
yep.
But that's all you got. And, you know, I move very fast. So usually within a week, we're doing our first batch of user tests.
Oh, wow.
From like whiteboard, like boom.
Yeah.
Prototypes ready. Let's go. We got 20 people coming in today. But that first round always sucks. No one knows what button to press. Everyone's like, all right, can you explain the value of this app to a friend? And they're like, not really. I don't really know why it's there. And I'm sorry. Like, yeah, everyone fetishizes failure in the startup world. Failure sucks.
I know.
Failure's hard. And yes, like we recognize it as necessary and there's, but it still sucks. And like, as someone who's a leader of these teams, when you have that first round of defeat, especially in a company, which is a huge corporation that's not used to failing like that,
right?
That fast. You have to be like, eyes on the prize, guys. Like, we're going to be fine, you know? And that's a big morale, like, as a leader in those teams, yeah. Like, pulling people through what can only be described as rejection. That's the mark of a good entrepreneur, yeah. Leader and a good innovator. But man, that first time where that first test where you're like, all right, guys, we have about 2 weeks of budget left. I don't think if we don't make it, there's nothing to hang your head about. And you have that first breakthrough and someone like presses the button and they know exactly why it's there. And you ask them at the end, like, flip the phone over. How would you describe that to a friend? And they're like, it's going to solve a problem that no other solution solves. I need it now. When can I buy it? And when you have that first moment where someone's like, fuck, where have you been all my life? That, I'm sorry, man. I would do that for free. Don't tell that to any of my clients. But that feeling when you created something that the world has never seen yet and someone uses it and is able to solve a problem with it and sees it as important for them personally, that's it, man.
Yeah.
And as an entrepreneur, the way in which that first moment of validation just sends ripples through the organization, through your team that really feels they're out on a limb. You know, when you're able to pull some stakeholders like Dave into the next session where that happens again and again, and they see that, wow, this was an idea 3 weeks ago. And now, like, everyone who sees it with no prompting knows exactly what it does, how to use it, and why it's important.
How important is speed? Because
speed is the most important.
Because, you know, you've seen these projects in 6 months, a year, 18 months, or, you know, they just drag on and
fuck
people lose interest over. Yes, fuck that shit.
I don't mean fuck that shit because
Which chapter is that?
Actually, the second chapter of this book is called If You Can't Launch in 8 Weeks, You Never Will. And I believe that fundamentally. And what I don't mean is you're like building the Death Star in 8 weeks. But I do mean is that you're getting to a level of validation with your user, with your market, and with stakeholders where it'd be a really bad mistake to turn back around.
Right.
And if you can't hit that inflection point in that amount of time and you suffer from analysis paralysis or politics paralysis or... you know, we have to build this in a giant, huge stack that's really much more robust so that we can accommodate 7.5 million active users. You're wasting your time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when you're in an organization and the rule is never pitch an idea, only pitch an outcome, man, you better be fast. You better demonstrate with fundamental results in a very short amount of time that you're dangerous if you're on the outside of the company and they're lucky to have you. And the only way you get that is with speed. Look, it always seems impossible until it becomes inevitable.
Yeah.
Speed is inevitability. Moving fast is, I don't know that we could stop this if we tried.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because my innovation lens is usually like marketing, right? Like, how do we use new and inventive ways to cut through the clutter and kind of even in some cases change the marketing landscape? Sometimes just like a blip, sometimes like, oh shit, this is how they're going to do it for the rest of the, you know, time or a period of time. I don't want to big up myself too much.
Go ahead, man.
For a week.
Do it, Chris.
I'm pretty fucking awesome. In case you guys didn't know.
I knew that.
But I mean, you touched on something with this idea of analysis paralysis, right? And I think in my world is sort of, hey, we have a slate of ideas that we're all like amazingly excited about, right? But then this one may bleed into PR, this one may bleed into product, this one may bleed into whatever. Like, and so now that client has to go talk to a bunch of other people, and now we're losing this 8-week, you know, window, which you mentioned, or this like this the speed. Because people, the excitement wears off. Have you ever come across a situation where you have to reinvigorate, you know, people on a concept? And like, how do you go about that? Because it can, like, the initial thing, like, then it comes to like, hey, well, why don't we change it? Or why don't we do X, Y, Z? Like, no, you fell in love with the first thing.
Yeah. I think the invigoration is, so first, let me say you're right. Like, in anything.
I know. No, I'm scared.
No, I mean, look, the nature of anything where there's like a rapid burst of acceleration and validation is that, well, going from 0 to 60 is one thing, but then going from staying at 60,
right,
just feels like you're in cruise control. Products are no different. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're going to launch something, you're going to go from nothing to something real fast and then at a rate that's never happened before. Mm-hmm. And then you have to just make sure it doesn't break.
Yeah.
And make sure you can kind of sustain it at that speed and then figure out how do you go from 60 to 120 and 120 to 180.
Without crashing,
you know, and that's a really, and eventually you're dealing with really big numbers.
Yeah.
I don't want to make it seem like I've cracked that code because injecting that kind of excitement into it after a while becomes kind of hard, especially when you're dealing with a really big and complicated stack.
Yeah.
I will say that you always have to let the user dictate your excitement. And I think that's the hardest part. That's the mistake I see happen the most often.
Mm-hmm.
Is you get into this debate with really smart, really talented, really creative people,
right?
All of whom have a different opinion about what's going to be the next step. And I think the right way to approach that is, sure, let's try it. And how can we get that out to market in a day? And how do we let the market's reaction determine who's right and settle the debate for us? Because I'll tell you something, if it was your opinion and my opinion and no, I'm an expert, Chris, and no, I'm an expert, Greg, it's like we're going to wind up with a compromise that is so lukewarm that it means nothing to anyone, including the people we want to reach in the market. And the extent to which, like, you know what? Shit, yeah, cool. Go to, like, take Mike with you. Mike is the rapid prototype, or have Mike put it out into the market. And if we hit a milestone that we know we need to hit and we see some real, like a real burst of growth,
yeah,
then you're right and I'm wrong and let's do it.
Very cool. There's no women in all your stories, but I'll throw Jane wrote in. No, there's...
Jane and I work together.
Yeah, that's what I saw that page 72. I mean, you've been successful on both sides of the coin, right? Once as an, you know, or multiple times as an entrepreneur, and then multiple times as an entrepreneur. What sort of skill sets have you learned that are transferable from one to the other? Like, you know, what can entrepreneurs borrow from entrepreneurs and vice versa?
Great question. I think the most valuable thing of an entrepreneur that an entrepreneur brings to the party is you have a really accurate understanding, even a visceral understanding of how fast you can move if you see an unmet need in your market and you want to serve that the people that have that problem. And that ability to just cobble something together with no budget, no rules, no resources, and yet somehow it's working. That's incredible. And the extent to which entrepreneurs often are like, well, we have to wait till the annual budget meeting and we're going to have to ask. I think this is a $2.5 million ask at least. Like, no, if you were in a startup, that would take you 3 weeks and $50.
Right.
So I think that ability to just move at startup speed and plant a seed and watch it grow.
Yeah.
I wish every entrepreneur had an understanding of that. It took me a while.
Yeah.
I also think something that a good entrepreneur understands is you live the political reality of your product all the time.
Yeah.
And I've seen a lot of entrepreneurs fall in love with their idea, fall in love with their validation and lose sight of where it fits in the competitive landscape of investors competing with one another or being frenemies with one another, mm-hmm. and other players in their space and the right alliances. The kind of political positioning of a startup, it's the job that most startup founders hate the most.
Right.
And very often they realize that it's a mission critical part of their job only once they're in like a Series C, you know?
right. Like, wait a second.
Like, I'm not the only one here. And it's not just us in the market. There's this infrastructure of internal management and external competitive forces. And it's our job to sort of marshal them into alignment with one another. Yeah. And I think a lot of startup founders neglect that. I'm going to say one other thing on that note. I've seen so many entrepreneurs leave because they felt alienated, and they go out and then they realize that inside of their, or alone anyway, and they go outside of their company and they realize they're like, they get 500 emails from like, hey man, I heard you're an entrepreneur, me too. And there's like, suddenly you're aware that there's this like dormant sleeper cell of entrepreneurs in the company, and you all right. form a startup and you then start eating into market share.
Is that the activated entrepreneur underground? Or is that
different? The activated entrepreneur underground, and that's an incredibly powerful coalition to build.
Yeah.
And the expat entrepreneur that goes on to be an entrepreneur and knows how to pull those resources and activate and cross fertilize them with startups.
Yeah.
That's a dangerous founder. You know, they're going to build something that I'll back that startup.
Yeah. Well, I think it's something to be said about, like, you know, there's always kind of like a chicken or the egg. Do you want to be an entrepreneur first, especially for like younger people coming out of college, right? It's like, do you want to go work inside of a company and really learn those intricacies of dealing with other people and the politics and seeing how they do it and really spotting, having a better opportunity to spot a hole, you know, where you can actually flourish? Or do you kind of go on that gut / whim, the knowledge that I do have and the passion that I have, and just like fight the fight, right? And I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer, but
I think it's important to get your ass kicked, you know, and I don't think there's a right answer, but I think at some point you have an understanding from going through doing the wrong thing.
Right.
Like, I may not be right, but I'm me. Yeah. And this is the career path that's right for me. This is the people I need to surround myself with and the people I need to avoid. And this is the work I'm capable of when I surround myself with those people. And I think once you're able to say, I need to work with people I love, solving problems I love. Once you know how to answer that,
yeah,
then that's the right answer. And there's no right way to get there.
Not bad for a Canadian international politics degree.
I learned it all in Queens. There you Queens, go. New York.
What did you want to be when you grew up? This doesn't seem like it was it. I want to be like the dad.
Oh, man. My first job out of college was I was a community organizer in New York City for the New York Blood Center.
Oh.
And that, and then
were you out on the pavement with clipboards and trying to get people to go? And was that okay? I'm sorry I ignored you. On behalf of the thousands of people who just, especially in New York, just you walk know, right past you.
All right, this is kind of crazy. I'm going to tell you this story anyway. So I was in charge of minority donor recruitment in New York City, in Brooklyn specifically. And that basically meant that, like, every Sunday I was at a church in, like, Brownsville or East New York or some of, like, they were black neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And I am not black. And
I noticed.
And I was, like, on stage every Sunday in these neighborhoods, like, hey, can you donate blood? Every Friday I was at a different mosque.
Yeah.
The Hasidic Jews. They knew me. I walked around in these neighborhoods and everyone knew who I was. Because I'll tell you something, Chris, what was fascinating about that job is, like, I didn't care if they donated blood. I was just happy that they were nice to me.
That's almost like a life philosophy.
Well, I just,
you know,
it was this total other, you know, and I grew up in New York City. I grew up in Queens, but it was not, I would just go to all the meetings they had throughout the week with the men's group and the women's group
right.
and the youth group and whatever it was. And, like, try to figure out, you know, what makes you guys do what you do? What gets you excited? What are you wrestling with? How can I be of service to you?
Yeah.
And it was only at that point when you're like, all right, I've got points in the karma bank account. Then the community would start to respond. And that, I learned more from that probably than anything else. The extent to which you can find people who are motivated by the same things as you are in the places you'd least expect to find them.
Well, so there's also that skill set of, like, going into an environment that you are unfamiliar with and thriving, right? And I think every entrepreneur faces that. It's like, I'm talking to somebody I have no idea who invited this person, right? Whatever.
Yeah.
There's so many different things you come up against. And I think, like, my sort of foundation, I guess, in that regard is stand-up comedy. So I did stand-up for like 7 years. And the same thing is, like, you go into a room full of strangers and you're trying to enroll them in whatever, you know, you're enrolling them in donating blood. Like, I'm like, do you think this is funny? But then when you turn that into, like, a business, you know, what you've been able to do, it's like you can survive within, because a lot of it is personality management, you know, too. It's like,
it's empathy.
Dealing with Clayton in a way that, you know, he's going to respond. Like, there could have been had it not been Clayton and a different personality type, maybe that conversation would have been
different. That same conversation go different.
Right.
Man, you were saying, oh yeah, this is what I was gonna say. I think the thing that I think most entrepreneurs get wrong is they tend to, like, flock to the sexiest technology rather than the most unmet human need. And so everyone is trying to build, like, a virtual, realistic, artificially intelligent Internet of Things, self-driving car with blockchain. And it's very crowded. And, like, some of the products that I've, one of the most exciting, thrilling products I ever built was for a concrete company in New York.
Yeah.
Old school. And the entire purpose of that was because the dispatcher and the guys who were out in the field pouring the concrete at the building sites had no, they were literally on Nextel walkie-talkies.
Right.
screaming at each other all the time. And it was just this very thin layer so that whenever someone was stuck at a site, they could press a button on an app and it would send a message to five other people in the field and to an artificially intelligent like chatbot, basically. And it would say, hey, I'm stuck. This is the problem. Can you help? And the extent to which people started to get along again.
Right.
And it wasn't like the workforce fighting their boss and the boss fighting their workforce. It was just, we were the first people to show up in that very unsexy market, which happens to be booming and growing.
Yeah.
And we were the only people that ever knocked on the door and said, hey, I think we might have something you might benefit from.
I think that's so valuable. You know, I think when you live in LA or New York or some major metropolis, it's like we all talk to each other about the sexy stuff. And then you go to Indiana and you're like, oh, wait a second. I mean, look, I grew up in Michigan and I remember a caddy, of course I remember, but I caddied at one of the top golf courses in the country. And some of the richest people I met to this day made like fabric for car interiors.
Or yeah.
we make corrugated board. It's like there's these other industries that far outperform financially and business opportunity than these things that we celebrate.
Yeah.
But as we wind down, so the show is called Innovation Crush. Yes, we went over that in our briefing. What have you seen out there that you are personally crushing on? Might be something in your own industry. Might be something, you know, a hike you took. I don't know. Like what's something that's kind of like. What's on your heart?
What's on my heart? Oh, man. You know what? I'm going to tell you two things. So one of them is Singularity University. You know those guys?
Mm-hmm. Very well.
Yeah. So I just started to get involved with them. And I love what they're doing in terms of... I associated them historically with like... exponential technology. And I think the extent to which they're digging into the human element, one of the statistics they shared with me, which just blew my mind, which is that if you look at the growth rate of 3D printers, it's less than the growth rate of microbreweries.
that is a peculiar way of looking at it.
Well, I just, you know, microbreweries are not using technology.
Right.
The reason they're growing is because they tend to be a product of the community they serve.
Right.
In fact, if anything, they strip technology away and do it in it's kind of this reversion to analog. And I think the expense that got me so excited, like
that's
the
great.
Extent to which exponential growth can be a product of removing technology. And connecting with someone human to human, I'm crushing on that pretty hard.
Yeah, no, yeah. I say the same thing. I was like, innovation is not synonymous with technology.
No,
you know, there's tons. Like the Museum of Ice Cream is probably one of my favorite things that's popped up because it's just like, you know, it's a brand new take on what a museum is. You know,
yeah.
what a museum experience is. Where people's appetite are for entertainment, like who would have thought, like that would take off the way it took off. And sometimes it's just a pleasant surprise that doesn't involve any coding.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Last but not least, complete this phrase for me. Innovation to me is.
Never pitching an idea, only presenting an outcome.
Boom. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Can I say one last thing?
You can say as many things as you want to. I do have a dentist appointment coming up, but
all right. Well, I wish you a pain-free dentist appointment. I didn't write this book to just get a bunch of people to follow me on Twitter. I wrote it to be of service.
Yeah.
And so if anyone out there who's listening to this feels like a stifled entrepreneur who feels like they're not having the impact they can because they're working in a company and they feel alienated. Like, I'm not joking. I want to hear from that person. I want them to do the greatest work of their life as an entrepreneur, and I think they can do that. And the reason I wrote this book is there is a way to do that inside of a corporation, because that company needs you to win as much as you need yourself to win. And so, like, anyone who feels that way, and I know that's a big market, and they don't have many places to turn, I'm greg@bowery315.com. Email me, put Innovation Crush in the headline, and let's get on a phone and let me help you. We're in a time where it's the best time to be an entrepreneur in human history.
Yeah.
And no one should let that pass.
That is a beautiful gift. Thank you. And the audience thanks you. And like, yeah, it's pretty awesome work, just period. And kudos to you for having this vision and actually just the emotional understanding of what the journey is like. So many, we focus on the keynote, right? The PowerPoint presentation. Well, I want to do that. But really understanding that there's an emotional side to this whole experience and that people can connect with. So thank you. And hopefully you do get more Twitter followers. Anything else?
That's @Gregory_Larkin.
There we go. anything else? All right.
That's it.
This Might Get Me Fired is the name of the book. Thank you, Greg Larkin, for joining us. Everyone, this has been another installment of Innovation Crush, and we will talk to you next time.